Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We are committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet, and today is no exception. Someone that I've known for a long time, we've had him on the Bible Answer Man broadcast. We've talked about so many different subjects: money, greed, and God, eat, fast, feast. I'm trying to think of all the books we talked about. You know, the whole climate hysteria. We talked about that as well. Anyway, my guest is Jay Richards. He's the director. You know, if I go through all his credentials, we're going to have a podcast in and of itself, so I can't do that. But anyway, he's the director of the DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family. He's the Senior Research Fellow in Religious Liberty and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. He's Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute. He's Executive Editor of The Stream. He's an editor, an author, and that of more than a dozen books. One of the books we've talked about on this podcast and on the Bible Answer Man broadcast is Money, Greed, and God, Privileged Planet, Eat, Fast, Feast. But the book I want to talk about today is a book titled The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. Now, Jay has the unique gift of being able to debunk mythology, and he does it in a poignant, powerful fashion. And that's one of the things I want him to do with respect to the AI hysteria that's taking place in our culture today, to give us a proper perspective on what we have to fear and what we don't have to fear. Jay has contributed many articles to the Christian Research Journal. For example, Everything You Need to Know About the Cult of Wokeism, Its Impact on Western Civilization. He sort of synthesizes in an article in our upcoming journal, Gender Ideology's Attack on Our Humanity. Jay has provided poignant testimony for SB 99 to the Senate Judicial Committee, in which he dismantled woke gender ideology. And one of the things he says in his article that impacted not only me, but many of our staff members, is he talked about the greatest assault on human nature that has ever been devised or imagined, and that is gender-affirming care ideology. And of course, that's a euphemism for hormones and surgical mutilation. But at any rate, I'm just delighted, Jay, to have you on this podcast. I appreciate what you are doing. Your testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee was incredibly powerful. I was actually not watching you. I was watching the people behind you, and I could see their consternation because you were bringing up realities that they probably never really considered before.
Yeah, I mean, this is, Hank, first of all, it's great to be with you again, but this is a very, very dark topic. And I honestly, I stepped into this gender ideology debate because I just got so upset about it. I mean, there really wasn't any other explanation for it. I mean, I had been exploring, as you just mentioned there in the intro, the kind of philosophical precursors to this. And in fact, there's a relationship between the artificial intelligence debate, so-called transhumanism, and gender ideology. If I was going to boil it down at least to anthropology, if you say, okay, so if we're going to just focus on the kind of the view of the human person, well, the truth about the human person is that we are created, I say, as we talk about Jesus being fully human and fully divine, humans are fully material and fully spiritual at the same time. We're both of these things. And if you don't get that, if you can't sort of comprehend and accommodate the compound fact of the human person as material and spiritual, you're going to split off. You're going to go in one extreme or the other, or you're going to be schizophrenic. And so that's what you get with gender ideology. People don't quite realize what's happening with this. I mean, gender ideology, as it's come to be sort of concretized in American higher education and unfortunately in secondary and primary education, is the claim that what you really are is this internal subjective state, this self-reflective thing called a gender identity that's independent of your body, so that you might have a sex assigned at birth, which is just a social construct, which doctors have sort of looked at you when you were born and they associate you with male or female stereotypes. But that's not what you really are. What you really are is this internal thing called a gender identity. And the only way you can find out, okay, what or who a person really is to ask them. And they might say they're male or female or non-binary or asexual, or, you know, it goes on and on and on. And so that's where you get the idea of gender-affirming care. What it's saying is that Okay, the problem is someone, you know, physically looks like a boy and says he's really a girl. The problem isn't that he has a false view of who he is, right, as an embodied being. Rather, it's just that his body doesn't match his gender identity. So if you affirm his gender identity, the way you fix him, the way you help him therapeutically, is to change his social surroundings, his name, his pronouns, and to change the body, the thing that's around the self, right, with surgery and cross-sex hormones. So you can see that it's a very bizarre false anthropology that's actually at the root of this. And what's happened? I mean, what's funny is that the people that came up with this were undoubtedly schooled in materialism. So at some level, most of them probably think we're really just a, you know, bag of chemicals or blind matter, you know, atoms colliding with atoms. That's all we really are. And yet that doesn't satisfy almost anyone. And so you first get taught materialism, you know, that that's not true. And so rather than embracing the kind of complex whole of the human person, you lurch to the other side. And so no, really, we're just this kind of subjective psychological entity out there independent of the body. Same thing happens with transhumanism, right? It'll be sometimes people that are actually materialists, but then they imagine that they're going to upload themselves to more durable hardware, right? To upload ourselves to a kind of future internet. Well, that's only possible if you were this disembodied self that could be transferred to a different physical substrate. And so what's happening here? Well, it's just complete metaphysical schizophrenia because of a failure to capture the complex whole of the human person. And it's coming home to roost now in gender ideology in the minds and bodies of children, because that's what makes this so toxic. It's one thing if Ray Kurzweil at the Google Corporation wants to fantasize about uploading himself to the internet, you know, in his mind. It's not going to happen. It's another thing to teach children they might be born in the wrong body and might need hormones and transition surgery in order to fix that problem. That's what gender ideology is. And I can't conceive of a greater attack on the human person and on civilization, because it attacks the human person. It also attacks us at the source of our blessing, in which God told us to be fruitful and multiply, right? Which requires the sexual binary. And so it attacks all those things. So it's attack on the person, on the family, on children, and civilization itself. And it's just not something we can sit idly by and allow to prosper in our culture.
What's interesting about this, Jay, is that it has not only embedded itself into already woke industries, but I was just looking at Chick-fil-A the other day, and I knew Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A. I have great respect for the organization, for the president of the organization, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But now they have a director of what I call DIE, Diversity, Inclusion, and Equity. And you think, how is this possible to embed that in the midst of a Christian worldview? I mean, the mission statement is overtly Christian, and that's embedded into that mission statement when it is diversity, for example, it's a good thing, but mm-hmm. not the way in which it is posited in woke yep. ideology. Inclusion is a good thing, but is a Christian included? Is a Christian worldview included?
Yeah.
Equal outcomes, equal opportunities. Well, we love equal opportunity, but equal outcomes,
right?
Or equity. So you have this strong arm tactic that's now mm-hmm. embedded itself even in Christian organizations. And I suppose, I should say Christian industries in this case, but I suppose that I'm interested in, you know, in your perspective of what can be done about that. Because let's say Chick-fil-A, and I don't mean to make an example of them, but let's say that Chick-fil-A says, you know, we're not going to go along with this. We're not going to hire a director of diversity, inclusion, and equity. Their supply lines are going to dry up. Their bottom line is going to evaporate. I mean, they're not going to be able to do any good, either nutritionally or in terms of market capital and so forth. They're not going to be able right. to protect their investors. What do you do?
Well, and so there's several things there, Hank. I mean, one thing, as you said, I honestly think some organizations, including Christian ministries that will get into the DEI stuff, they think, well, those are good terms and we'll just sort of invest them with our own meaning. That's sort of what they imagine, right? Is we'll do it, but we're going to define it in sort of Christian terms. That's not how this stuff works. So they find very quickly is no, actually we have very precise meanings for these terms. And many corporations, including I suspect Chick-fil-A that get into this, they're not into the kind of woke critical theory that inspires these things, which is really a form of a kind of conflict theory that's really just a kind of cultural wrecking ball more than anything else. they just are worried about their bottom line. And what's happened is that very, very large financial institutions like BlackRock, massive, think of these as sort of bundlers of capital in the trillions of dollars, in which the funding from lots of different investors can either, you know, come your way or be withdrawn from you. They tie themselves to these particular goals, to equity goals, to some of the goals of the human rights campaign, which pushes the gender stuff and the DEI stuff. And so corporations feel like, look, we kind of have to do this unless, you know, I don't want to ruin our capital to completely dry up. And then we, as you said, we won't be able to do anything. The way we stop it is first by raising the awareness of the American people about what exactly is happening, in particular Christians who ought to be able to discern the dangers in this at the beginning. It seems like it's everywhere and it's already infiltrated all of our institutions, and in a sense it has. But here's the thing, is that most of that infiltration happened when people didn't realize what was actually happening. They didn't actually realize what diversity, equity, and inclusion meant, for instance. Most people still don't actually know how gender ideology is being taught to kids. And this is what makes me hopeful, strangely, is that its attack on children, in particular so-called gender-affirming care, this medical intervention with children, I think this is, just to put it bluntly, the devil has overplayed his hand here, because this is so outrageous, and it's outrageous at a completely different level than the stuff that had gone before. This is not like same-sex marriage. This is not like a lot of the things that people imagine, because the law is written on the human heart. And one of the most basic things that people have, even in their fallen state, is an attachment and a desire to protect their children. And that's what these people have actually awakened. They've awakened the so-called suburban moms who were supposed to not presumably think about anything, all of a sudden said, wait, what are you teaching my sons and daughters? And they're waking up. And so that's why I think you've actually see this here in the last, you know, the beginning of 2023 Pride Month, is that there is a reaction that we did not see before. And I think it's that more and more people are realizing how utterly toxic and evil gender ideology is. I mean, the fact that Elon Musk himself on Twitter says doctors that do this should go to jail. He's saying this, right? This makes this different than anything else. And so I think what we're seeing, I think of it as a moment of grace, in which just how diabolical this ideology is now on full display for everyone, so that we're getting an opportunity to see, okay, wait, this is evil. We got to stop it. And secondarily, how did we get here in the first place? This didn't drop out of the sky. This came because of particular cultural ideas that had been developing. And so I honestly feel like it's an opportunity, right? God sometimes gives us a glimpse of where we're going and the catastrophe down the line ahead of time so that we have a chance to turn back. That's how I see this particular battle.
That's very encouraging. You know, that's one of the things I notice about you is you're always looking at the glass half full as opposed to half empty. You're seeing the silver lining. And in this case, you're saying the devil overplayed his hand. In terms of the financial incentive, this has become a $1 billion industry, maybe a $1 trillion industry. If you think about kids becoming patients for life, there is a real financial incentive to all of this.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a few months ago, I wrote a piece. It was just telling the story of this financial analysis of gender medicine. And it was this, it's sort of weird because you could have thought, okay, are they talking about microprocessors or what are they analyzing? And it was simply an analysis of the likely growth in this industry over time. And the report was saying, well, it turns out the customer base for these procedures has grown exponentially over the last few years and promises to grow even more. The surgeries themselves are very, very expensive. The customer base is growing. And as you said, they're permanent, right? So the surgery itself might be a kind of one and done, but the surgeries actually have lots of complications and usually need follow-up. And even if they go as well as could possibly be expected, cross-sex hormones are forever. You have to take those the rest of your life. And so there's a massive financial incentive now that's kicked in here. I don't think that's what initially caused this. I don't think some greedy corporations got together and said, you know, how can we push this? But once this thing sort of for ideological reasons found its way into the culture, drug companies and medical organizations, look, they have financial incentives and they are absolutely paying attention to that. And that's now, unfortunately, a part of the dynamic we have to deal with.
Talk about the intersex condition. doesn't that prove that there are more than two sexes? I mean, a lot of people
it's not
say
true
it
that there are more than two sexes. Yeah. In fact, the word intersex itself is another one of these kind of words designed to confuse us. What they really are referring to is disorders of sexual development. And so these are very rare, but these are disorders that lead to, a type of kind of ambiguity. So it's not easy for a doctor, say, to tell if a newborn is a male or a female because of one of these disorders. Now, they're very rare. It's 0.018% of the population has one of these disorders. And so in those cases, the normal way we easily tell if somebody's male or female, it may be hard, right? They could have ambiguous genitalia or something like that. Now, they're all either male or female. They're, in other words, they fall into one or the other of the phenotypes, which are what are males and females? So the male and the female, these are the two sort of ways in which mammals and humans have for our reproductive strategy. So the way we reproduce, it requires one small mobile gamete called sperm and one large, relatively immobile gamete called eggs or ova. And then we have these body structures arranged according to those two gametes. There's no third gamete. There are no ergs or spegs. There's just sperm and eggs. And so that's why it's really basic biology. Sex is binary. Some people have disorders that make it more difficult to tell if they're male or female, but that doesn't mean that sex is not binary. Gender ideology, though, plays on this because most people that are educated will be vaguely aware that there are these so-called intersex conditions, these disorders of sexual development. And they'll think, okay, so there is some fuzziness around the edges. Maybe that's what gender ideology is about. It has nothing to do with that. In fact, if you talk to someone who says they're transgender, virtually none of them have disorders of sexual development. But this is part of the plan. So if you're wondering, like, you see the LGBTQIA+, the I is intersex. They're trying to rope that in so that people that don't quite realize what's happening will think, well, the gender ideology stuff has to do with that. It has nothing whatsoever to do with disorders of sexual development, which neither correlate with these supposed gender identities nor instances of other sexes.
You've already alluded to this, Jay, but is gender ideology a pathway to transhumanism? Expand on that.
Yeah. And so in the case of some individuals like Martine Rothblatt, so Martine Rothblatt is a very rich individual. He's a man biologically, but he transitioned and so presents as a woman now, hence Martine. He was the founder of SiriusXM, though he sold out his share when it had its IPO. He's moved into biotech. In fact, he works in cloning. He's a huge contributor of the cloning of pigs, which are sort of useful for learning about human beings. He has developed, Rothblatt, an actual transhumanist religion. Listeners could just Google this, in which he describes it as a kind of a catechism of transhumanism. And he sees the connection directly. Because if you imagine, look, if I'm independent of my sexed body, so that the fact that I'm a male is independent of my identity, and I could somehow sort of transcend that. And that's the very next step is, well, why couldn't I transcend my body in general? Why would I need this particular body? Why couldn't I have a more durable body or a type of hardware? And so you notice it's once you get the idea that we're this disembodied self, right, that's independent of our body, it's not hard to imagine, okay, well, maybe that self, I won't just get surgery on this body, I will get a different body or some completely different sort of material substrate. So these are intellectually kissing cousins, and one sort of prepares the way for the other. I don't think there's any coincidence that these ideas would emerge at the same time and place in history or in the minds of some of the same people.
This is so interesting. You know, obviously your article in the Christian Research Journal is important reading for everybody, but I want to transition now from this subject, although it's related, as we pointed out, to the human advantage, the future of American work in an age of smart machines. And by the way, this book is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. I read this book some time ago, and then I started rereading it when I heard about all the AI hysteria. I thought, I got to go back and see what Jay has to say about this, and I wonder if Jay's changed his opinion. I went back and read this book, and it reminded me that you are on the cusp of exploding mythology. You're taking current myth, the worst of all is the materialist myth, and we will get into that a little later. But this book, anyway, it's available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. It is available on the web at equip.org. You can write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. This is an important book to read, and I think it's an important book to read not only about AI, but about AI hysteria, meaning when you read this book, you come to a proper valuation of things and you say, whoa, this may be the cusp of something very significant in terms of possibilities, limitless possibilities. So anyway, I want to talk about this book. You explode the popular myth that all economic growth is in a rearview mirror, that capitalism is all about greed, the wealth of some causes the poverty of others, which you call the zero-sum game myth.
Right.
Elaborate on that.
Well, all of these myths actually, again, they tie back to a false view of the human person. That's something that's sort of surprising. And this is, you know, been a theme of my work for many years, is that a correct understanding of the human person is necessary for understanding human society, for understanding what's best for us, and for understanding economics. Economics is the study of, you know, the way in which humans buy and sell and exchange goods and services and information, usually in a context of scarcity. So the way we interact and how we produce wealth and create wealth and value for each other and for ourselves. So you got to understand what the human person is to be able to get that. But unfortunately, people often, even Christians, when they're thinking about economics, they think like materialists. So they imagine wealth, for instance, as if it's just this fixed amount of material stuff. It's like this, like a pie, right? And if pie is a finite physical thing, somebody gets a third of the pie, they're going to leave less for the rest of us. So you want to sort of divide it up equally. Of course, that's not how wealth in an economy is. Wealth grows because we actually create value and wealth that was not there before using the material world that God has given us. And so all those things are really, really important when we come to think about all these issues. And they're important when we come to think about technology and this particularly hip technology called artificial intelligence. On the one hand, because I think we should always think about technology as an extension of human creativity. We don't have technology without human beings. We're the ones that create that. But in the case of artificial intelligence, you have actually a couple of other myths involved because of the word itself. So I think artificial intelligence is the greatest marketing coup ever devised by man, because somebody had called this complex sorting algorithms, right? Statistical sorting algorithms. That's just like you just go right to sleep. But that's actually what these are. These are just sorting algorithms that sort according to particular rules, different data, and things like that. They're not agents. They don't choose things. They don't know things. They're not conscious. And we've gotten that in our heads so that we think of computers and we think about artificial intelligence. Well, it's artificial right now, but at some point it's going to get complex enough that it's going to wake up and it's going to be like us. That's a false view of actually just what's happening in the technology. But it also is related to a false anthropology, because people often think of humans ourselves as machines. So you think, well, if we're just complex machines, especially if you're a materialist, we're just complex machines. We're sort of blind matter in motion, natural selection, sort of culling random variations over time. We became conscious and became agents. So who's to say that these machines that we're designing to be smart won't also become conscious? So if we're machines and we're conscious, what's the problem? And if you read the AI literature, you'll find that slippage. But then if some philosopher shows up and says, yeah, but you're not dealing with the hard problem of consciousness, the strong AI advocate will say, well, what is consciousness really? I mean, who's to say that we're conscious? Maybe consciousness itself is an illusion. And so either they elevate the machine to the status of a person, or they denigrate the human person to the level of a machine. So you can see how misconceptions about economics and misconceptions about the nature of the technology and misconceptions about the human person, they all converge in this debate, which is frankly one of the reasons that I have been interested in it now on and off for probably 20 years, because it brings several really fascinating things together.
Someone as smart as Elon Musk, I mean, I find him to give very poignant and intelligent answers to a lot of questions, but when he was asked about consciousness, he wasn't so sure there was such a thing as consciousness. He didn't dismiss it out of hand, but he also wasn't sure there was such a thing.
Yeah. So he is, you've got to remember, he's a really smart guy. He was one of the co-founders of PayPal, but he has been marinating for decades now in the California, Silicon Valley sort of universe. And that is where this ideas about transhumanism, you know, are, that's sort of the hotbed of them. There's this other idea that he actually, you know, I don't know that he believes it, but he entertains it. This idea that we actually, the universe itself is actually a sophisticated simulation, that we're actually in a simulation. He's smart enough to be able to get this, I think, very quickly. I think he knows the technology, obviously, but it is so much a part of the air and the water in the tech scene in California that a lot of otherwise really smart and insightful people will kind of fall for these things that they really ought not to fall for. I'm hoping with Tesla's move to Austin, maybe that will ground him because he's got such common sense on so many other things. But I'm not surprised that he also at the same time is also kind of worried about Skynet waking up. So he's incredibly gullible when it comes to these myths about artificial intelligence, unfortunately.
So you're making the dogmatic declaration right now that machines will never trump human intelligence.
I will make this claim. First of all, the computers are not going to become conscious agents. They're not going to become persons, and they're not going to be able to replicate what the human person is. Am I saying that machines can't do things better than humans? No, of course not, because wheelbarrows carry more than I can carry, right? A tractor is stronger than I am. We can make machines that do lots of different things. That's why we make them, to enhance our own capacities. And so we're doing that when it comes to information technology as well. What we're not doing is replicating what the human person is. We're mimicking certain things that humans do, just like, you know, a calculator. Once you've got a calculator that can do arithmetic, it's going to do it more quickly than we do. It's not doing it like we do it, but it's doing a function that intelligent things do. It doesn't follow that we're thereby going to make these things that can genuinely replace us, because they're just completely different kinds of things. They're machines. We're animals and persons and intelligent agents. Those are not the same kinds of things. And you don't get intelligent agents just by building a fancy, faster machine. It's really a category error. I'm more than happy to continue predicting that Skynet's not waking up. Google is not going to create an intelligent agent. We have things to worry about. That's not one of the things that we need to worry about.
So what about chess? This is something you mentioned in the book.
Yes.
Can a machine ever outwit a human being in chess in the ultimate sense? Or will the human being always have an advantage over the machine?
No, I think, I mean, honestly, if the purpose of chess in this case, right, is just to sort of win, to checkmate and to beat an opponent, we've had machines that could do that since 1995, right? I mean, IBM did this. We managed to create a machine that by running enough calculations could beat the world's greatest chess player. But that's because it's something that can be reduced to a system of rules, right? And so it's, in some ways, it was bound to happen once we got a computer that was fast enough that could run through lots of different calculations. We don't do that though. Human chess players, they don't run through all of the millions of possibilities, right? They do this sort of thing in a different way. And so, yeah, it actually turns out wasn't as hard as we thought it was to create a chess program that could beat really good chess players. It doesn't follow that it replaced chess players. What's happened is that chess competitions now involve, they're called centaurs, in which you have human machine hybrids in which the great chess players actually use the machines. And so they compete using those machines. This is just as building race cars didn't replace track, right? It's just that we now race cars with people driving them. And so I think that's really the way to think of it. If you think of technology as a prosthesis for our bodies and for our minds, you're going to be less likely to imagine that they're going to replace us, because this technology depends upon us. Now, it does have a feedback. It affects us once we create it. Smartphones, for instance, the second everybody had a smartphone, that had huge psychological and cultural implications that we're still trying to work out. Nevertheless, we're the ones that created those things. They did not create us. And you got to keep that in mind and sort of focus on what the technology actually is, not on what we've seen and imagined because of sci-fi literature, which is a lot of what people are worried about, is honestly animated by what we've seen in movies and what we've read in science fiction.
You're stimulating me to so many different questions. I'm thinking right now about the fact that we moved from Southern California to Charlotte, North Carolina in 2003. 2007, the first iPhone came out. So 4 years after we moved, and that's almost incomprehensible to me as I think about it right now. But what I wanted to ask you about is the fact that you can go to, I'm going to go to Africa here in a few weeks' time. You go to Africa, you can find someone quite literally in a loincloth with billions, maybe trillions of dollars of technology in their loincloth or their pocket.
Yeah, or at least technology that would have been worth trillions of dollars a few decades ago.
Yeah.
Exactly. Many people in villages without running water, not just in Africa, but in Asia and Latin America, will still have cell phones. That's an extraordinary thing. And it globalizes the economy and the human population in a way that we've just never experienced before, for good or for ill, because people are now, I mean, at least a third of the population is effectively connected to this kind of one thing at roughly the speed of light and at very high fidelity, so that we could talk to each other thousands of miles away from each other with HD video. That's just a completely new thing in human civilization that we're just beginning, I think, to reckon with. And I don't pretend that it's all wonderful and rainbows and unicorns. All these things are mixed blessings. The printing press was a mixed blessing. Learning to read as a human population was a mixed blessing. Probably caused us to have poorer memories and more nearsightedness. But that's what this is. This isn't like some fundamentally different kind of thing. It's still technology that we've developed that can enhance us, that can also debase us. And it's going to be up to us to decide, okay, which way that's going to go. But we shouldn't spend all of our mental energy focused on things that just aren't going to happen. And computers waking up and becoming conscious, just not going to happen. So whatever we have to worry about in the world, let's not spend our energy on that.
Yeah. So talking about the glass being half full as opposed to half empty, which is a trademark for you, you look at the opportunities when the agrarian society morphed into the industrial age and then the industrial age into the information age. You're saying that there are tributaries of opportunity that are unfathomable.
Absolutely. I mean, just think how crazy it was. So 200 years ago, about 5% of the American population was doing something other than farming. So something, but 90 or 95% of the population were farming or had these sort of direct livelihood connected to the farming industry. Well, now it's less than 2%. And yet we can easily, if we wanted to, we could produce enough food to feed the entire world. That's the result of innovation and enterprise and entrepreneurship and societies that allow us to accrete wealth and value rather than to destroy it, and technology, which has allowed us to produce more and more with less and less. And when things are going badly in culture and in the economy, it's hard not to focus on that. But I always encourage people, look at the kind of long-term century scales of these sorts of things. It's absolutely astounding. So we went from almost everyone for most of human history being involved in agriculture all the way up to a few hundred years ago. Cut that in half by 1900, it was at about 50%, you know, and now it's a tiny percentage. And that doesn't mean now 99% of the population are not unemployed, right? They're doing something else. Most of what we're doing now, people couldn't have imagined 100 years ago. It's not like these jobs were out there waiting. They emerged from a kind of sort of new stage of our technological development. And that's where we are now. And I can tell you, if you sort of study the history of technology, every one of these inflection points, people freaked out because you see some of the awful things. It's actually easier in some ways to see the awful things than to imagine what could be coming around just around the bend. And that's honestly, I think more than anything, I want especially Christians to be kind of cultural analysts and interpreters and to understand what's happening and also to be able to use these things for good rather than ill, because I think the temptation for a lot of Christians, you see the proliferation of technology, is to think, okay, well, this is just bad. And so we're not actually a part of the process of interpreting and using it properly. But the first step to using it properly is understanding what's exactly happening.
Yeah, we're losing our seat at the table. I want to read something from your book. It's a paragraph. Bear with me. I hope it's important for the audience, but it has to do with Moravec's paradox. I love the way you illustrate this. So I'm going to read a paragraph from your book. When I pick up a wine glass, I fill it with Pinot Noir, or in my case, Chardonnay. Then I hand it to my wife. The action relies on complex feedback among my mind, eyes, and fingers. I know how fragile the wine glass and the wine bottle are, and I adjust my grip based on input from my fingers. I rely on my sense of balance and direction. I can tell up from down and know not to turn the glass sideways after I filled it with wine. I know to stop pouring before the wine overflows. No matter the size of the glass, I can easily hand it to my wife and decide to let it go once I feel and see that she has a firm grip on it. I can't say how I do any of this. I don't follow a set of rules in my head. I just do it. But the computational and engineering resources needed to replicate these feats in a machine are so vast that we haven't managed to do it yet. Robots excel in structured environments, not unstructured ones. This is Horovec's paradox. It bears unpacking.
It does. And it's named after a famous robotics professor named Hans Moravec. But the idea is that we actually find it easier to automate and to replicate with machines intellectual tasks that we think should be hard, accounting and complex math functions and calculations, chess playing. That's actually much easier than replicating what human beings, every three-year-old can do with his or her body in three-dimensional space. And he says that's a paradox. As you would imagine, well, the machines, the first things those are going to take care of is the housekeepers, right? There are not going to be any housekeepers because we're going to have, you know, Rosie from the Jetsons is going to be the housekeeper. Well, guess what? Here we are. We've got machines that can build unbelievably complex machines and microprocessors. There are no rosy housekeepers. And that's Moravec's paradox. The things you think would be easy are hard, and the things you think would be hard are actually fairly easy. Now, what does that mean? Well, what this means is that when we're thinking, okay, so what are the future jobs going to look like? We need to take account of this so that there's a bunch of stuff that people were doing in the 20th century that was sort of low-skill work that's easily automated. And in fact, some of the socialists at the time in the 19th century, they would look at factories with assembly lines and where people were just doing the same repetitive thing over and over and said, this is not dignified for human persons. They're doing the work of a machine or of a beast. And in a sense, that's true because they were just doing the same thing over and over. But in the 20th century, we had these amazingly productive factories with assembly lines in which you had lots of people doing kind of low-skilled things. Now, we sort of feel bad because a lot of those sort of factory towns have now disappeared, in part because of disruptions from trade with China, which is one issue, but also because they become much more automated so that our manufacturing sector is actually much more productive per worker than it was even a decade or two decades ago because of automation. And so it says, okay, so what are we going to do with, say, millions of people that don't have college educations? They're not going to all code. They're not going to all be engineers. We need to have factories for them. Well, no, that's not right, because Moravec's paradox tells us the stuff that's going to be hard to automate is the stuff where you have to do complicated stuff with your bodies. There's a whole set of jobs and professions called the skilled trades that qualify. So everything from painting and plumbing and electrical work and HVAC repairmen and mechanics working on cars and high-end construction, it's going to be a long time before we have machines that can actually do that. But the things that we sort of picture that were happening in factories in the mid-20th century, those are the things that are going to get mostly automated. Now, I'm just talking about the blue-collar sector here, too. The same thing's going to happen in the white-collar sector. And so by understanding this, we can sort of imagine, okay, as a society, if we're wanting to encourage the development of certain kinds of skill sets for blue-collar workers that don't go to college, we want to be encouraging them to develop proficiency in the skilled trades, not spend a bunch of time talking about, you know, replicating factories from the 20th century, which are going to, in fact, be almost entirely automated before long.
You're an educated person. You've got a lot of degrees. You tend to depreciate the educational process, particularly when it comes to the humanities. The universities have become, not just universities, have become indoctrination centers.
Yeah, they really are. And I should say in the book, of course, I'm talking about this kind of very narrow topic when I'm talking about education. I am a huge believer in the real liberal arts, in the great book schools. My children did it, were homeschooled. My younger daughter graduated from a great books classical school here in DC. She's out at the University of Dallas, which has a great books program. That's liberal arts and humanities the way it's supposed to be done, right? In which you learn to synthesize ideas, you have to speak, you have to kind of construct arguments on the fly. That's fantastic. The problem is that all these liberal arts schools and so-called humanities programs, for the most part, have been completely infiltrated by alien ideas, so that they're not actually doing that. What they're getting is varieties of critical theory in the various disciplines so that they're just a complete disaster. And so if that's going to be your option, I say, you know, if you do engineering, you're much more likely to kind of learn to be an engineer. That's not to deprecate liberal arts and humanities as it should be done. It's just that that's kind of the basic reality. And the bad news, Hank, is that even math and engineering are now actually being infiltrated by this woke stuff. So the ideology sort of, they started in the humanities, they work their way into the human sciences, and they're working their way all the way up to math and the hard sciences. And at some point, we're going to have to say, look, that's quite enough of this stuff.
Talk a little bit about AI and medical diagnosis. You point out in the book that AI has some great advantages over, let's say, the hunch of a doctor.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, there's going to be this kind of complex interplay in medicine between the role of the machine and the role of the person. But I think the role of the person is going to become more, we call these in business school, we call them the soft skills. And I don't know why we call them that, but the idea is the hard skills are the, sort of the, I don't know, the mathy stuff. And the soft skills is interpersonal. And, you know, for a doctor, it would be the bedside manner and those kinds of things. What happens though, when machines, let's say that you've got using machine learning, which is a whole other topic, but you've fed, say, millions of x-ray images of diagnoses of breast cancer, right? So I mean, you have millions of these, you've fed these into an algorithm so that it becomes really, really good. Maybe you're using the Watson or some version of Watson that was developed by IBM. It just becomes really good at diagnosing with, say, 99% probability if, you know, a spot on the screen is actually a malignant tumor or not. And it's just way better and way faster than the diagnostician human that could have done that. Doesn't follow that there are no humans involved. What it means is that the human skills for the physician end up being much more important in fetching a greater premium. So I actually think, honestly, that physicians that are actually good with human beings, that know how to use the machines for the kind of technical stuff, that may be where the medical profession is going, because the kind of rule is anything that can be automated probably will be automated. And so what you want to do, if you're saying, okay, what are the jobs of the future going to be? What should I encourage my children to do? Have them focus on the things that can't be easily automated and that will complement these so-called smart machines that are emerging.
Explain what the lump of labor myth is, and maybe just an overview of how you debunk it in the book.
Yeah. So the lump of labor, economists use this phrase. And it's basically the idea that just as you might imagine, there's a fixed amount of wealth in the world, right? So that if somebody has too much wealth, they've taken it from someone else. Well, that's a myth, because wealth can be created that wasn't there before. You can think of jobs in the same way, so that you can think of jobs as if they're consumer goods, so that there's, say, a million jobs in some state in the United States. And if those jobs go away, then you've lost that net number of jobs. The idea is that there's this fixed amount of work, jobs or labor. That'd be the kind of abstract thing. There's just this a pile of labor, stuff to be done, work to be done. And once somebody else can do it, or if a machine can do it, then there's less work to be done. And so you're going to end up with a bunch of unemployed people because of technology. This is the kind of background assumption that always leads to these dystopian predictions about the role of technology. And so apply it to history. So imagine if that's true, that there's this fixed amount of work to be done, then what that would mean is that once we developed tractors, everyone that was using, you know, hand plows and shovels would not only be out of work, but would be permanently out of work, because now, whereas it took 10 people to produce a certain amount of food, now it only takes one person or one-tenth of a person to produce the same amount of food. And so all these other people are just extra. There's nothing for them to do. That's not actually how it works. And so we know this historically. This is why you can go from, you know, 95% of the population working on farms to two centuries later, you know, less than 2%. We've got a population that's, I think, about 10 times larger than it would have been then. And yet it's not like 99.9% of the population is unemployed. We're doing completely different things at a much sort of higher standard of living. That's what actually happens. Technology, it does do this. It absolutely can displace a particular way of doing something at the moment. So as soon as there are tractors, there's a lot of ways of farming that are suddenly obsolete. It doesn't mean there's nothing else for anyone to do. It's that it turns out they will do new things that are not yet imagined. Now, who imagines those? Who creates those new jobs, those new ways of working? Well, that's the role of the entrepreneur. They anticipate other needs and wants that people could have, given the kind of new set of technology, the new set of opportunities. And so you don't want to buy the idea that there's a lump of labor, because you end up making the mistake that could have been made 200 years ago. Somebody could have said, we can't allow technology to be used in farming because it's going to put a lot of people out of work. And we would all still presumably what? Be using non-mechanized machinery or something like that, and be much poorer and unable to sustain nearly the number of people that we can now. So that's the basic idea. Don't think of either the total amount of wealth in the world or in the economy, or the total amount of work to be done, as if it's a fixed amount of stuff. Technology can disrupt particular ways of doing things, because sort of temporary unemployment and displacement, it's not going to lead to greater and greater numbers of unemployed people, which is what a lot of the books, unfortunately, on robotics and AI predict. They say we're going to end up with all these basically surplus people without anything to do in the near future.
Elaborate just a little bit on critical thinking skills. It seems to me that many Christians, you're a Christian, I'm a Christian, many Christians lack critical thinking skills in a very complex age. It's not just the world. It's Christians who ought to have great critical thinking faculties because we have a proper worldview. So we've got a leg up. And yet I find a dearth of critical thinking.
Yeah, I know this. And it's, of course, something that, as you know, it sort of frustrated me for a long time as well. And so the question is, so what is critical thinking exactly? And in some ways, it's just thinking really hard about the assumptions behind any particular view, so that you could sort of anticipate, okay, now what, if that's true, I've got some premises that are leading to a conclusion. If this premise is true, what am I assuming must be true? And then sort of working your way back. So like the lump of labor myth, you could say, okay, well, if I imagine that this technology is going to make a bunch of jobs be obsolete and everyone's going to be unemployed, what else am I assuming? I'm assuming that the amount of work to be done is fixed. And so that if this work is done at a current stage by machines, there will never be anything left for anybody to do. Well, that doesn't follow at all. All we could say is that, okay, these particular types of work are going to be obsolete. And so that's unfortunately not what we tend to do. And I mean, of course, everyone all the way back to Plato has realized this, is that what you want is for your emotions and your passions, you don't want to get rid of them, but you want them to be put in, reason to be in charge. So reason is sort of driving the horses of our passions in the proper direction. Unfortunately, too often, even for Christians, we just kind of let our passions and our impressions sort of run away with us. And we don't actually use the reason that God has actually given every single one of us. And so critical thinking is really just using the gift of reason that God has given us, and not just sort of falling for stuff. And this is absolutely essential to do it in this day and age, because there's so many bad ideas out there that if you don't do this, you're almost certainly going to end up with the wrong ideas about almost everything.
Yeah, you give some keys. Spurn myths, which you just alluded to. Reject bad advice. Debunk bad philosophy. Prepare rather than panic. And you elaborate on those virtues in The Human Advantage, the book itself. You say the key to the future is human virtue. What is virtue, and why do you think it's so important?
Well, so virtue, I'm just sort of assuming the kind of biblical and Aristotelian and Thomistic analysis of this, that virtue is the result of habits in which we sort of choose to do the right and the good over and over and over. So it's a willed thing. It's not just this, not the automated thing. The fact that I'm hungry right now is not the result of virtue. It's just a kind of bodily function. But if I show up on time, if I'm showing up on time, that is because I have practiced over time, intentionally leaving on time so that I will be punctual and not be late. And then if you do that enough, it becomes a habit. So in other words, you kind of do it automatically, without thinking about it. So it starts out as a willed thing that I had to do, even though I didn't want to. Then it becomes something I kind of do automatically. If I keep doing it, it works its way down into my being so that I'm now just a punctual person. And now it's no longer effortful. Then it's a virtue. It's not just a habit. It's not just a thing I'm forcing myself to do because of a New Year's resolution. It's a virtue. And it turns out for economic prosperity and for a healthy life, for a happy life in the robust sense, the flourishing life, you need certain types of virtues, both natural virtues. You know, eating properly is a natural virtue. It's not a sort of supernatural virtue. Then, of course, also the supernatural virtues of love and faith and hope. all those things, you know, it is a matter of habituating those things in ourselves. And we know this about children. We just know that you got to get kids used to doing stuff over and over, and then it works its way down into our system. Now, we happen to know now, because we've studied the brain in more detail, that there's this thing called neuroplasticity. And if you do things over and over, it builds up particular neural pathways, so that we, by our choices over and over in our habits, can actually rewire our brains, right? So we go from the will to the physical structure of our brains, which I think is actually, that's just a confirmation of this idea that we're spiritual beings, we have agency and freedom and will, and we are also material beings that have bodies.
Why do you spend so much time on virtue in a book that has to do with whether or not machines are going to replace men?
Here's why. Because, of course, from what I just mentioned, virtue starts with habits, and habits start with will. And so consciously chosen actions for a purpose, they're indirected, right? But you choose to do something for a purpose. Machines cannot do that. Machines do not have foresight. They don't have agency, right? They don't have thoughts in which they could say, okay, I'm here and I want to go there. I choose to go here, even though I'd kind of like to go here. I'm going to choose to do this. That is the exclusive jurisdiction of intelligent agents. That is one of the major things that distinguishes human beings from machines, is that we're agents. And so if you focus on the right virtues, what you're doing is you're basically focusing on what economists would call our comparative advantage over machines. These are things not only that we'll always do better, but that in fact machines don't even have access to. Machines don't have access to virtue in the same way. And so that's kind of the top line lesson of my book, or the piece of advice. Focus on the stuff that's uniquely human, and that's, if you're worried about jobs, that's uniquely human and that will contribute to the sort of economic flourishing of others. And you're going to have a place in the global economy, no matter how high tech it is, because machines aren't ever going to be able to do that. But the economy and everyone else is still going to need that. That's kind of the idea. And so I ended up just sort of diagnosing, okay, here are the features of the information economy, and then here are the virtues that correspond to those features that I argue we should really focus our attention on.
Let's talk about some of those virtues. Courage, for example. What is courage from your perspective? How do you delineate that in the book?
Well, courage is being willing to act even in the possibility of failure. So courage is not the absence of fear, and it's not just doing something stupid and impetuous. It's acting for a purpose, but acting for a purpose even with the possibility of failure. So it's sort of, it's a golden mean between cowardice on the one hand and, you know, impetuosity on the other, in which you just sort of stupidly do things. Now, why is courage so important in an information economy? Well, it's important because there's very, very rapid change. Information technology, unlike, you know, say the agricultural economy that, you know, lasted for thousands of years, in which change was very slow because of things like Moore's Law, in which you get exponential growth, not just in microprocessors, but in storage devices and network technology and fiber optic cables, stuff changes really, really quickly. And so what that means is that, unlike most of history, in which industries might exist for hundreds of years, we're entering a time in which you'll get radically new industries that will emerge. They'll really be the thing for a while, and then they'll disappear. So there's a lot of disruption. And so because of that, that means that if you can sort of train yourself not to be overly risk averse, but to be willing to try things and fail, that is a very, very valuable asset. Whereas it might be that a kind of overly conservative disposition of just wanting always to do the same thing and do the thing that your dad did and that his dad did and his granddad did, that might have been useful in a time in which change was very, very slow. But actually a willingness to take risks and to try things, even if you fail, and then if you fail, trying something else purposively and intelligently, that ends up being one of those virtues that's really optimized for the information age, in which change is going to, and disruption happen very, very quickly.
And Apple's the quintessential example.
Absolutely. I mean, I love the story of Apple. And, you know, of course, the company now is complex. It's also a relationship with China is complex. Steve Jobs himself was not really a great guy. He was not a charitable person. He wasn't a great father, but he was an amazing and creative entrepreneur. And we now, when you think about Apple, is one of the most valuable companies. In fact, I think it's the most valuable brand in the world, certainly in the top three. We think of it now because of its amazing success. Certainly the Mac, I've got a MacBook Pro I'm using right now, but the iPhone in particular, And of course, they had the Lisa computer, and they had a couple, if you know the history of Apple, just complete disasters that nobody really remembers. But Steve Jobs is willing to try things, you know, purposively poured himself into it. One point, people that are old enough may remember he was actually booted out of Apple and then he came back. And it's a perfect example. Now, a lot of times anybody that reads the, say, the entrepreneur literature will always get this little lesson. Okay, you want to, you know, be willing to fail and fail and fail again. Well, that's not the lesson, because of course you can just keep failing, right? You can kind of keep stupidly failing. And so you want to be willing to fail, and that's courage. But you also need to be able to learn from failure and to improve from every experience. And that's what the Apple Corporation has done so far, certainly what Steve Jobs did. And I think there's a lesson there for us. And so the virtues that I talk about in the book, they stack one on top of each other so that you optimize yourself for the information age in the particular sort of job situation. And in fact, this is actually a course that we use. I taught for many years at Catholic University. There's a course on this now for students of entrepreneurship to kind of learn to develop these things. And I really do think we all imagine, okay, I need to get a master's degree in coding or something like that, which, hey, that's great if you can do it. But in fact, there are these virtues, these very human qualities that I think are actually going to be the things that are more important to prosper economically.
One of the virtues that you underline in the book, which I thought was just brilliant, is the virtue of anti-fragility.
Yes, and anti-fragility, actually, it's layered on top of courage. So what is anti-fragility? Well, the term is from Nicholas Nassim Taleb, his book, Anti-Fragile. And here's the idea of anti-fragile. It's a weird sort of word, but we tend to think of things as being either strong, as rigid, or fragile. So something's, you know, breakable and brittle. So it's something like a piece of china, it's really easy to break, or it's something strong and hard, like a piece of thick steel or rebar. And so we imagine those are sort of the two options. So what's anti-fragile? Well, anti-fragile is the asset or the virtue or the property of actually getting stronger or better when perturbed or disturbed. Say, well, what is like that? Well, China's not like that. Or crystal glass is not like that. Steel's not like that. Steel doesn't just get stronger when it's disturbed. Organisms are like that. So organisms, as long as they're disturbed within a kind of the proper range, actually improve. I mean, anyone that lifts weights knows this. And so the purpose of lifting weights is initially, you're actually sort of tearing micro tears in your muscles. You force yourself to sort of endure a heavy load. That's called progressive overload. You lift and you break down the muscle, and then you wait and you eat and you rest and you recover. And your body doesn't just build it back the way it was before. It builds it stronger than it was before. Well, that's an example of anti-fragility, in which a kind of controlled disturbance of the system makes it better than it was before. Now, what is that in terms of a virtue? Well, anti-fragility would be not just the willingness to act even if you're going to fail. That's courage. Anti-fragility is the ability to learn from your failure so that you sort of travel up the sort of knowledge curve in your particular discipline. So anti-fragility is a system of biological organisms. It's also a virtue of intelligent agents that can learn and learn specifically from failure, so you don't make the same mistake twice. This is a really potent idea, this idea of anti-fragility, and actually applies all over the place. I talk about it in my fasting book, because we imagine, well, we'd be better off. The best situation is where we eat all the time, right? Very consistently, and never allow our bodies to go without any food. It turns out that we're not optimized for that. We want to be in a situation where we're eating plenty of food sometimes, we're feasting sometimes, and then sometimes we're not eating at all. That actually makes us healthier and better. That's how our bodies are designed, so that we're sometimes perturbed. Now, perturbed means, doesn't mean starve to death, right? It means withdrawing food and sustenance so that our body can do other things. And it turns out we're healthier as a result of doing that than we would be otherwise. So that's the idea of anti-fragility. And it really applies all over the place, though in the human advantage, I'm just applying it as a virtue for adapting and learning from failure in an economic situation, which things are changing all the time.
I mean, this has real practical ramifications. When you look at the kind of coddling that's happening in universities, for example, we're not teaching people anti-fragility. We're teaching them fragility. We're enhancing that vice as opposed to the virtue.
We're enhancing it. Exactly. And in fact, there are now some books on this that we're actually creating psychopathology in people, in which they're highly anxious, unable to sort of deal with it, just the normal kind of everyday struggles of life. And of course, we know this, fathers in particular. I mean, there's a lot of studies to show that on average, fathers and mothers parent differently. And fathers are more likely to try to get their kids, whether they're sons or daughters, to do stuff that will challenge them, whereas mothers are much more likely to nurture. And we've certainly seen that with our daughters. And in fact, they joke about it now. My daughters are older now, and they say, oh yeah, you always wanted us, you want us to be anti-fragile. Come on, give us more comfort here. I want you to be prepared for the world. You know, comfort isn't going to allow you to do that.
Yeah, great. You know, one of the virtues that you write about is altruism. And a lot of people think that altruism and capitalism are incompatible, but they're really not.
Absolutely not.
Well, how did that myth get perpetuated?
It got perpetuated because people misunderstood a popular argument that Adam Smith made. Adam Smith is really the father of modern economics. He's a Scottish moral philosopher. He wrote this book in 1776 called The Wealth of Nations. And Smith makes a very important argument. And people often quote him, you know, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. So in other words, he's talking about, okay, the butcher doesn't have to be visualizing world peace or thinking how much he loves you. He could just be thinking about the fact that he needs to pay his rent or get his daughter braces. But because of a market economy, he can't steal from you, right? You've got rule of law. And so he will have to provide you something that you want, right? He'll have to be a better butcher than his competitors and sell you meat that you like and at a quality and a price you're willing to pay. And he will be doing that for self-interested reasons because he needs to pay his rent. So he doesn't have to be benevolent. And so people take that to mean, well, and so in a market economy or a capitalist economy, people can just be greedy. Smith wasn't saying that at all. He never praises greed. First of all, he's mostly talking about self-interest. But he says, no, we have constant need of benevolence from our fellow human beings. It's just that in a normal course of life in a market, people need to be able to prosper, not just by thinking about others, but also by meeting their own needs. Now, people took that to mean, oh, that greed is good. And so a capitalist economy requires greed in order to prosper. And in fact, this myth has just kind of emerged from this. But notice that the butcher himself, even in Smith's analysis, is acting in an altruistic way. Altruism means acting for the benefit of the other. It's the Latin word alter is in there, which means other. And so the butcher is acting for the benefit of his customers. He's other directed in his actions. It's Smith's point was only that what you want in a market economy and the genius of the market economy is that it allows people to provide things for others to act altruistically while meeting their own needs at the same time. So it doesn't have to always be a zero-sum game. It's not that the butcher has to benefit his customers by punishing himself. Both can actually be better off as a result. That was Smith's argument. It's absolutely ingenious. It's crucial. And it's crucial for understanding what actually happens in successful businesses. Somebody that is literally an entrepreneur that all he is doing is, or she is doing is thinking about, okay, how can I get rich? I could care less about the customer, care less about the product. That is not going to be a successful entrepreneur. Successful entrepreneurs, if you study them, are usually people that are seized by an idea. Now, yeah, they may imagine they're going to get fabulously wealthy, but they imagine this thing that if they could produce it, could meet a need or a desire that people have, things that don't even exist yet. Steve Jobs and the iPhone. People weren't sitting around saying, man, I wish I had a smartphone, right? It wasn't even a category. He was able to sort of anticipate this. That is a type of altruism, an altruism of orientation and behavior. So that there's a subset of altruism that's self-sacrifice. That's what we think of when we think of Mother Teresa or, you know, a Marine falling on a grenade to save his fellow Marines. That's a subset of altruistic activities that involve self-sacrifice. But most of the altruism in commerce is a different kind. It's beneficial to others. It's other-directed, but it's also beneficial to the provider. And so that's what I want people to think about is that type of broader form of altruism, because that's the one that's more appropriate, I think, to commerce.
I want you to really underscore that point. I mean, you're a master at turning the tables. You say self-interest is not necessarily greed, but is actually the basis for the golden rule. So just sort of a recapitulation of what you just
Absolutely.
Said.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so self-interest, selfishness is a disorder. Selfishness, all sins are sort of disorders of things. And selfishness is, or greed, right, is a kind of misordering of one's priorities. And so you're focused on yourself or the desire for something, even at the cost of yourself or others. That's a selfishness. Self-interest, I'm breathing right now. So every time I breathe and take a breath, or you take a breath, we're acting in our self-interest. Every time you look both ways before you cross the street, or go to bed on time, or show up to work on time, you're acting in your self-interest. None of us think, well, that's sort of a necessary evil that I have to do that. No, that's how we're designed. We're embodied beings that exist in particular times and places. We need food and air and shelter. And if we're properly functioning adults, we are able to do those kinds of things. And so there's nothing wrong with that. And so that's why when Jesus's formulation of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, what's presupposed? What's presupposed is there's a proper way that things ought to be done to you. So in other words, you have a proper interest in yourself. And if your conscience is properly formed, you can actually use that as a guide to figure out how you should treat others. So if you have a properly formed conscience, you're going to understand what you as a human person need to flourish. And then once you realize that, you can say, okay, now, so because I need this to flourish, other people need that as well. But notice you can't even do that sort of moral calculation unless there's a proper interest that you have. That's what self-interest is. And so what we want to think of is this kind of proper domain of things over which we have control and interest that involves ourselves and then our families and our children and our spouses. That's our self-interest. Selfishness is a distortion of that. And then when we're properly ordered, we are able to use that to realize how we ought to treat other people as well. So notice that actually makes it more sense of our moral lives. It also makes a lot more sense of our economic lives as well.
One of the juicier sections of your book is under the subheading, quote, don't follow your passion. Why not follow your passion?
That is, and so I have to tell you, Hank, I used that thing and I spoke at some Christian high school commencements and just started. I said, look, I know most people are going to be told, follow your passion and your dreams. I'm going to tell you the opposite. And I could tell you that high school kids didn't like it. And every dad in the audience, when I gave this speech at these commencements, would like take a notepad and start writing it down. Because yeah, exactly. So here's the idea. Of course, the passion is just kind of the thing emotionally that we like and that we want to do. And so because of the fact that most of our passions are disordered, telling people they ought to follow their passion is actually a terrible idea in terms of economic advice, because you might be passionate about all sorts of crazy things. You might be passionate about something that's bad, but let's assume it's not. Let's say it's morally neutral. But let's say you're passionate about basketball and you want to be a professional basketball player, but you're also 5'3" and really, really uncoordinated. And so it's probably a bad idea that you would try to spend all of your energy being a professional basketball player. Why? Because you're never going to be very good at it. And if that's sort of job advice, you're not going to be able to make a living at it. What you want to do is find the kind of overlap. If you had a Venn diagram of the things that you're good at, the things that you could be good at, so that you're sort of naturally gifted to do, the things that you could improve, and the things that if you could actually provide needs for others and also provide for your needs, because that's any kind of economically valuable activity is going to be something in which you're producing value for yourself and for others. And when you find those things, my argument is that what you actually do is you find your calling. Most of us don't actually know. God doesn't give us a call on the red phone and tell us, okay, this is exactly what you're supposed to do. We find our calling by kind of testing in this way. But what you'll find is that people that do this, that are really, really happy with their jobs and their professions, that feel fulfilled, it always involves value creation. And it may be doing something really, really boring. I tell the story of Mike Rowe of Dirty Jobs, tells the story about this guy that was a septic tank company. Well, nobody woke up and said, my calling is to clean septic tanks, right? But he found a way to do it. And he loved doing it because he's got good at it and he's creating value for other people. That's actually what happened. And so my argument is find what you could be good at that can provide value for others. You will find your calling and your passions will follow. They will build upon that if you do that. Notice that's kind of the path of virtue. Whereas if you just start out with whatever kind of suits your fancy, you may not find that. It may be something you love to do, but you're not ever going to make a living at it. And so you're never going to create value doing it. And so the best it could ever be would be a kind of self-indulgent hobby. So that's the idea. But it's, of course, it's not, my argument isn't go find a job that you're miserable doing, because that's just what you're supposed to do. That's not the claim at all. It's that if you do this a different way, you will find the thing that you're actually genuinely, in a sustained way, passionate about, that will also allow you to create value for others. And that's when you find your true flourishing economically.
We can't leave this one alone. You say, as career advice, follow your passion implies one of three things. One, what you want to do right now will match what someone will pay you to do. Two, people ought to pay you to do whatever you want to do. And three, people should be forced to pay you to do whatever you want to do. And you say, dumb, dumber, and then evil.
Yes, evil. Exactly. So people should force you, like, look, okay, I wanted to be a rock singer, right? This is, I will confess, this is an idea, but I'm probably, let's say I'm just not any good at it. I can carry a tune, but let's say I'm terrible. But if that's your passion, right, and you're supposed to follow it, in order to actually make a living doing that, you'd have to force people to pay you to do it, because nobody's going to do it voluntarily. And so you're basically, that's slavery, right? When you force somebody's labor to do something, that's a form of slavery. And so that's kind of working it out economically. That's crazy. Now, of course, you're never going to be in a situation to be able to force somebody to pay you to be a rock singer. And so what you're going to end up doing is probably either advocating policies that are terrible economically, or just never actually finding your calling and never finding a way to create value for others. And so value for yourself economically. And that's a bad thing, because I think God, he commanded, he created Adam and Eve. He blesses and commands them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, so that our reproductive capacity as humans, that is to produce after our kind, and to produce, to be fruitful, right? Those are actually related capacities of being made in the image of God. And so we find our fulfillment as humans made in the image of God, both in our families and also in our economic productivity. And we want both of those to be in alignment. But to find how to be economically productive, we have to find something that will create value for others, because that's what economics is about, is producing value. And so it's always going to ultimately be oriented toward the needs of other people.
So I want you to elaborate on this just a little more. So I, just making this personal, I found the needle in the haystack doing what I'm doing right now. And I remember my dad saying years ago, your work ought to be your play. And that's exactly how I feel. I mean, it's not that what I do is easy, but I love it because I've been created to do this very thing.
Yeah. It sounds like, and you found it, right? You found yourself in it. And it's, and my sense, and I know people like this, that, well, you ask them, okay, how did you end up doing this? Oh, I just knew I always wanted to do it. And I would say that's, sometimes that happens. Like you said, sometimes you find the needle in a haystack. But if I'm going to give a group of 120 college freshmen advice, sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you're oriented properly and you have the intuition to be able to figure that out. The other thing is that some people are really good at lots of different things, right? And so some people are just very gifted. They are musical and they are disciplined and they have wonderful personalities and they're great at math and they're very athletic. And so it turns out there's 1,000 things they could do. And so they could, you know, there's a, one of the 1,000 things, they'll pick the one that they like and they're going to prosper. But if you're sort of talking about averages, right, the humans are a normal distribution, I'm going to give everyone advice. I'm going to say, okay, what I want you to do is find the thing that you could be good at and you could develop that would also create value. And sometimes you have to, I say that in the book, you might have to try 3 or 4 different things before you find this. But that's a much more reliable way for the average person to kind of find their calling than this idea to follow your passion, just because of the fact that very often our passions are disordered. That wouldn't be true if your passions are properly ordered. If your passions are governed by your reason and your conscience is properly ordered, then your initial passions might actually be a valuable guide. But I'm sort of working on the assumption that most people don't have their passions aligned in that way.
Yeah, again, that's a juicy part of the book. It's worth getting the book just for that one section, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. Another one of the virtues you talk about is collaboration. What does it mean to collaborate in a hyper-connected age?
Well, this one is the one that's, I think, the most intuitive, because, of course, we everybody knows what it means to be hyper-connected. I mean, we, in fact, there's my friend George Gilder developed this idea of Metcalfe's Law, which just describes the way in which the value of a network increases. I don't know, I have it memorized, but it says it increases as the square of the number of users, I think is what it is, which just basically means the whole is not only greater than the sum of its parts, but the larger the whole, the larger the members of a network, the much more valuable it is, so that you get this kind of exponential growth in the value of a network as things are connected to it. And now we live in a world, as I mentioned, for most of human history, people, our networks are much smaller. And so even until a couple hundred years ago, the only way you could sort of communicate with someone more than a few miles away was the speed that a horse could get you there. We now are networked in ways that are beyond anyone's imagination until a few years ago, for good or for ill. It also involves TikTok and internet porn and all those kinds of things, but it means there are all these different ways of collaborating and working with people. And as a result of that, my argument is that the virtue of being able to work with people to enhance their value ends up being a more valuable skill than it might have been earlier on. And so people imagine that, say, the job of the manager is going to be obsolete. Trust me, robots aren't going to be the people that encourage teams to work really, really hard toward a goal that seems almost impossible. Those are valuable people skills. And so again, in business schools, we talk about the hard skills and the soft skills, that ability to collaborate, by which I just mean the ability to work with people and to enhance the value of everyone so that the value of people working together is much greater than the individuals could accomplish by themselves. That's always valuable in business, but it's going to be even more valuable now that there are so many different kinds of ways for people to interact and to collaborate, because now it's not just your sort of value in a meeting in person, but your ability to interact with people, maybe over text, over Zoom, over the phone, all these different kinds of ways that certainly, especially since the COVID lockdowns, all of us are now somewhat aware of. Well, if you know how to do those things and you do them well, you're working with people. Notice this is a human skill. This isn't a machine skill. My argument is that that's going to be really, really valuable. That's going to fetch a premium in the economy of the 21st century.
So if I think of Jay Richards as a rugged individualist, I'm buying into mythology.
Yes. So the idea of rugged individualism, it's sort of popular if you're thinking about the Soviet Union and this giant collective thing, right? And the kind of defense of the rugged individual that lifts himself up by his own bootstraps, that's a kind of valuable myth. But if you actually look at American history, read Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. He's not talking about rugged individuals. He's talking about these villages and churches and communities that go out on the prairie and then they create a church and a saloon and a little school. They're not doing this by themselves. And this is a very much this kind of basic biblical idea. God creates Adam as an individual made in his image. He also creates Adam and Eve, right? Both made in his image. And then they form a family so that we are absolutely, we're individuals with our own value and dignity and rights and duties, but we're also intrinsically social creatures, and God has made us that way. And so what we shouldn't do is imagine that the two options are kind of this all-powerful state in which the individual is subsumed into this kind of collective blob, or we're these isolated, atomized individuals. No, we are individuals that are designed to exist in community. That's true of metaphysically, but it's also true economically. The whole point of economics is how people buy and sell and exchange goods and services together. And so my argument is that, again, kind of properly Christian understanding of the human person, it gives us a balance so that we don't imagine ourselves as either isolated individuals or fall for these ideas that, you know, it takes a village or that the government is the thing that we all do together, right? No, our sociality is something that's very particular and very concrete.
How is creative freedom a virtue? You call that a virtue.
I do. And so that's the capstone virtue. And so freedom, unfortunately, is this word that means different things to different people. And so I say that the way we often imagine freedom is that freedom is just getting to do what you want to do. And this is how teenagers tend to think about it. So if you make them come home, you know, at a particular time, then they're not as free as they would be otherwise. He said, okay, well, that's a type of freedom. It's what philosophers call the kind of freedom of indifference or libertarian freedom, the freedom to choose between alternatives. But there's a much larger kind of freedom. And this is what the American founders all talked about, this in terms of liberty. And the example I use is of, say, a child learning to play the piano. I'm sitting here, Hank, in my living room. We've got a grand piano right across here. And let's say you buy your child a piano, your daughter when she's 5 years old, and you say, okay, you're free to play. You can sit down anytime you want, day or night. You're free to play on that piano. Well, she can, right? In other words, she's an agent. She can push the keys. Is she free to play Rachmaninoff? Is she free to play that third movement of Moonlight Sonata, which almost nobody plays because it's so hard? No, right? Her freedom is extremely constrained. How would she have the freedom to make music, to play Rachmaninoff? She would sit herself down on that bench day after day, play the hard scales, play those hard measures hundreds of times. She'd habituate and develop virtues. She would constrain herself, right? In a sense, you might think, oh, she's limiting her freedom. She's limiting her freedom for a purpose. And what it's going to do is it's going to open up a wider range of freedom to be able to make music. That's what I call creative freedom. It's a self-constraint of your options for a particular purpose. And in this case, for the creation of value. And we actually find freedom there. So it might sound strange to say, how is freedom a virtue? It's a virtue because it requires these habits and virtues actually to be able to sort of open up those vistas that a great musician has only by years and years of focused discipline. And that's, of course, sort of the capstone virtue for the human being in an information economy, because again, only humans are agents. Only we can have wills and develop habits and so develop virtues and create value and choose to create value. So that's the lesson. Focus on the things that are uniquely human, unique to agents made in the image of God, and those will always be complemented rather than replaced by machines.
Yeah, so we're talking about machines versus human beings. And I want you to help us understand what meaningful information is. Also, the difference between weak artificial intelligence and strong artificial intelligence.
Yes, and so the information question is hard. So let's start with weak and strong. So weak artificial intelligence is all the AI that we actually experience every day. So when you do a Google search, there's not someone in Cupertino, right, or Mountain View, California, answering your Google query. That is the result of a complex algorithm that they've developed that surveys the way in which other pages are favored and finds you an answer that's eerily similar when it's working properly. It hadn't been curated for political reasons. It's eerily similar to what you were looking for. That's weak artificial intelligence. So it mimics what humans do for some particular task. When, you know, Deep Blue beats someone at chess, that's weak artificial intelligence. Strong artificial intelligence is the idea that you can create an artificial intelligence that will be in relevant ways like we are. So in other words, it will have agency, it will have consciousness, it will be able to act for purposes, it will be free. That's strong artificial intelligence. And very often the debates in AI, people will elide from one to the other. So they give you these examples of what are in fact weak artificial intelligence, and they sort of ask you to imagine, well, we just keep going along this path for a while and suddenly they're going to sort of wake up. I mean, it's very much like saying, well, natural selection in biology and random variations, it can explain this variation of these finch beaks in the Galapagos, and just do that a little bit more and it's going to explain everything, right? It's a kind of false extrapolation to something that's completely different. And that's what's actually happening. And so the distinction is really important to keep in mind. All the AI that we're going to experience is weak AI. My prediction and my claim is that if you really think about it carefully, you can't have a strong artificial intelligence. It's a category error. Now, the question on information has to do with, really, it's at the heart of the idea of the information economy. We talk about, you know, the agrarian economy and the industrial economy and service, and now an information economy. Well, what is that? What is information exactly?
And what is meaningful information?
Yeah, what is meaningful information? The reason I say meaningful is because in information theory developed by Claude Shannon, he's interested in analyzing how much signal you could get over a channel, right? So some kind of signal over copper wire or something like that. And so in order to transmit information, you need a stable channel. So in other words, like the wire, it can't be disruptive and doing random stuff. It needs to be stable so that you can, you know, let's say you have a telegraph signal over that channel, can be coded in a particular way. And this is the idea of a bit is a unit of Shannon information. And a bit is just basically you flip a coin and it could heads or tails, you flip it, it's tails. That's one bit of information. All right. Now, this is really ingenious way of sort of analyzing, and we figured out, okay, now you can compress information to get more over a channel and then uncompress it on the other end. It's all the basis of computing technology. It's great. But it doesn't capture what we mean intuitively by information. What we mean by information, when we're talking about it, is meaningful information. So it's the difference between random sequences, right, that might be 128 bits of information, of random sequences of letters. Okay, just imagine it that way. Or 128 letters that form an English sentence. Now, both of those would qualify as the same amount of Shannon information, but we notice that only one is meaningful. Only one communicates information from one agent to the other. This is absolutely crucial because people will often imagine, okay, well, machines can produce and create a certain type of information. They don't produce meaningful information in the same way. If you say, okay, where does that kind of information come from? Again, it is the exclusive jurisdiction of intelligent agents. The example I use in the book, and I think I got it from my friend Steve Meyer, is of the Victoria Harbor. When you go into the inner harbor of Victoria in British Columbia, in the summer at least, the side of the kind of grassy hill, right when you pull up near the provincial parliament building, there's an arrangement of begonia flowers, red and yellow, that say, "Welcome to Victoria." And so what's the information there? Well, you might say, okay, well, was it in the seeds or in the flowers? Is it in the properties of the flowers? Is it a kind of physical property that could be deterministically derived? Well, no, of course not, because the seeds can be arranged in lots of different ways. The information is the kind of arrangement of the seeds, but it's only information because what's actually happening? Well, when we've come into a boat on a ferry in Victoria Harbor, you suddenly see it and you realize, okay, that's meaningful information because it communicates a message. I'm in Victoria, somebody meant to send that. You don't do probabilistic calculations, you know immediately that that's a message. So what the machines can do is all the kind of physical stuff, and they can transmit the message. They are not the source of the message, of the meaning. And that's what's actually important. So we're going to develop machines that can transmit and can crunch and can vary with complex sort of design algorithms the kinds of information that we produce. So they're elaborating what we produce, but the unique, meaningful information that we produce of value will always come back to an intelligent agent, to a human being. And that's my claim, and that's my prediction, and it's a risky prediction. And so I'm predicting machines are not going to do what you people in the strong AI community are telling us they're going to do. And I'll bank my argument on that. Let's see what happens. In the meantime, Christians shouldn't panic about these predictions about artificial and strong artificial intelligence. They should rather understand what's actually happening with the technology and using it for the production of good and for the advancement of the kingdom of God, because it's, once again, it's an opportunity just like the printing press to do that. And it can be used for good or for ill. And it's going to be up to us to use it for good.
Why do you say it's a risky prediction? Doesn't seem to me, after all the...
I don't think it's risky at all. I think there's zero probability that machines are going to wake up, right? It's only risky in that it could be confirmed or disconfirmed by future evidence. So if machines really do wake up and they're agents, then it's like, oh gosh, okay, well, Jay didn't predict this. This is contrary to his prediction. So it's only risky in that sense. Now, I think metaphysically, it's not, because I really don't think that this is going to happen. So it's only risky in the sense that it makes particular predictions about what can and can't happen in the future.
Why do you bring happiness into the book? Is the happy life the virtuous life?
Well, the way I'm defining it, yes. But because happiness, I'm using happiness in the traditional kind of Thomistic and Aristotelian sense, not happiness in terms of sensual pleasure, but happiness in the sense of eudaimonia, right? So it's a kind of a fullness. And so there is a natural happiness in which, you know, you read Abraham and he has many children, and there's a kind of natural happiness and fulfillment. And you have a full stomach when you have a good meal. That's a natural happiness. But then there's also a supernatural happiness, the beatific vision. There's the fact that Paul can be naturally in a situation that you would imagine would be unhappy, in a prison and just having gotten beaten and in chains, and yet happy at a spiritual level. My book is mainly about the kind of natural happiness, but I think it's still a spiritual reality because, again, we are not ghosts trapped in bodies. We are embodied persons that are fully embodied. We believe in the resurrection of the body. And so our lives on this earth actually matter. And so what we want by happiness is a kind of true fulfillment and purposiveness. That's the type of happiness. And it's much broader and more complex than the kind of narrow sensual pleasure that we often use when we use happiness. But it's sad, but the word happy in English has unfortunately been kind of made vulgar. But I think that I just honestly think the answer to that is to recover it. And that's what, if you study the kind of literature on the so-called American dream and happiness, it's never about sensual pleasure. It's always about sort of finding your purpose and being able to raise your family and live a peaceful and fulfilling life.
I want you to talk just a few moments about regulation. So many people are talking about the need to regulate AI. If you take this, as you do in the book, to other regulations where during the Obama administration, for example, you had, 20,000 regulations that were supposed to enhance the American dream, but actually detracted from it.
Yeah. And so, I mean, of course, it should be clear, I'm not an anarchist. I think we need the proper laws and rules and regulations in order to live a fulfilling life. We don't want the sort of state of nature, this law of the jungle. Nevertheless, we very often add regulations, which are kind of coercive rules that the government enforces on certain kinds of economic activity, on the assumption that it's going to help, but without working out the implications of what it actually does. And so we end up with all these regulations that actually do far more harm than good. I'm here right outside Washington, D.C. right now, and I can tell you that the vast majority of those regulations in the Federal Register, nobody really thought carefully about the implications of those. And this is one of these things. And so even people like Elon Musk have talked about, well, maybe we need to regulate and control the development of artificial intelligence. But before we even answer, should there be regulation? I want to say, now, why do you think that this should be regulated? And very often what they're saying is they don't want it to become conscious and become Skynet and kill us all off, right? So the very purpose for which they're advocating regulation is based upon this misconception about what the technology is. Now, I do think that there should be laws. I mean, I'll be honest, I would be perfectly happy if the federal government banned TikTok, for instance, not because I think they should be banning private technology, but because in this case, I think it's spyware from the Chinese government. But in general, this idea that we're going to control the development of artificial intelligence, not only does it not really make any sense, but we need to be really good at artificial intelligence. We need to be really good at developing the chips and developing the software that does this. Because trust me, there are bad people in the world. There are communist regimes elsewhere in the world that are doing this as well. And so the last thing we want to do is hobble ourselves technologically. And so any kind of debate we want to have about regulation should at least be based upon what it actually is. And a lot of the talk I've heard about regulating AI is based upon these kind of mythological predictions that it's going to do something that it actually is not going to do.
Do you worry about, I probably shouldn't use the word dumb, but ill-informed people making the regulations? You sort of alluded to that, but I mean, I think this is one of the concerns that I have is that we saw this with COVID. We see this in all kinds of areas. You have people that have not exercised critical thinking faculties producing regulations that become counterproductive.
Absolutely. I mean, I assume that's the only way that this could possibly happen. I mean, Hank, you know, in 2013, I wrote a book called Infiltrated, which is at the fifth anniversary of the financial crisis, to kind of assess, okay, what happened in the crisis and what were the regulations? We ended up with this law called Dodd-Frank that actually made the situation worse. The problem was that banks were acting in a particular way and using these particular securities and not assessing the proper risks, in part because some of the big ones knew they'd probably get bailed out if they got into trouble. Turns out that's what happened. Well, Dodd-Frank, rather than saying, okay, no longer are we going to allow banks to think that they're going to get bailed out, we designated these big entities, systemically important financial institutions. So we made it official. The very thing that had caused the problem, we made official. That is just, it's not necessarily the people doing this were dumb. It's that they don't understand the implications of what they're doing. And in fact, sometimes really smart people do this stuff, but they're not capable of actually anticipating these things very well. And so that's why I always say, look, assess any regulation. Do the benefits exceed the costs? And do you really, are you in the position to be able to anticipate both the benefits and the costs they're coming, or are you just kind of just guessing it based on your moral intuitions? I suspect, you know, 90% of what we have on the books of the Federal Register would not be there if everyone were forced to exercise that kind of intellectual discipline.
Yeah, a good summary statement in your book is that all technology is Janus-faced, and that the only antidote to danger is virtue. And that, of course, is why you wrote about the virtues. So the only antidote to the danger of AI would be the virtues.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I spend a lot more time worrying about what humans are going to do with the technology that we develop than the technology in isolation. It's the fact that we're interconnected is not itself a bad thing, but if we're all vicious, then when everyone's interconnected, we're able to enhance and magnify our viciousness. And I think that's where we want to focus these things. Besides which, we aren't really in control of, we could squelch our own development of technology. We're not going to be able to prevent everybody else in the world from developing technology, and there are bad actors out there. And so the way that you resist the bad actors in a foreign policy context is by always being able to meet them so that there's a kind of parity of technological prowess that we will always have. And frankly, I'm worried about the communist government in Beijing, who are, you know, they're a serious country. I worry that maybe we're not. And this idea that we're going to just sort of suppress our own technological development, I think seems really, really foolhardy.
Yeah. We've touched on this during the entirety of the podcast, but I think as you do in so many different forums, I think we need to reinforce one thing. You say to fully understand why machines won't replace us, you have to see why materialism is false. I mean, that's at the root of everything, the materialist myth.
Absolutely. I mean, so if you imagine that the total amount of wealth in the world that's created is just sort of what we have in front of us, then you're always going to imagine, well, if somebody gets wealthy in an economy, they've extracted wealth from somewhere else. And so that just generates this constant worry that, okay, we need to have exactly equal outcomes because if somebody's a little richer than someone else, they're causing someone else to be poor. That's not how it works in a market economy, or certainly it's not the way it has to work. People can get fabulously wealthy, not by extracting wealth from others, but by creating wealth that wasn't there before. I mean, again, Steve Jobs, not a great guy by most accounts, he did not get rich stealing iPhones from homeless people. That's not how it worked, right? But if you assume materialist picture, then there's just a kind of finite amount of physical stuff. And so you're always imagining, well, if wealth is just really material stuff, there's only so much of that stuff to go around. And so breaking out of these kind of economic myths requires, in some ways, really breaking out of the materialist worldview, which cultivates these things. And I think this is the sort of weird thing, Hank, about the moment in which we live, is that people can be both materialists in one part of their brain, but also like some kind of weird, you know, it's not a Platonism, it's whatever the opposite of this, in which we're just this kind of disembodied soul on the other. And so Martin Rothblatt's probably metaphysically a materialist, and yet he also is imagining that he's going to upload himself to, you know, some future internet.
Cognitive dissonance.
At one and the same time. Yeah. And the only way I can account for that is that people at some level down in their souls actually know that we are both spiritual and material. And so even if they kind of officially deny it in their philosophy, they're constantly going back and forth between two opinions.
Talking about dangers, I just want to mention Jonathan Turley. He's a well-known George Washington University law professor. And he talked about how he discovered ChatGPT falsely reporting on a claim of him being involved in sexual harassment. And he talked about that, and it underscores the danger of AI, right?
It does. And of course, ChatGPT is this chat bot that's developed by particular people. It's drawing information from the internet, and it's following particular rules that are built into the system. And the first thing people noticed is that it was politically biased, first of all. Well, the reason it's politically biased is because it was set up to do that. And so people are imagining, oh, the chat bot's bias. Well, no, it's reflecting the bias of the actual biased human beings, right? But another thing is it doesn't actually know what it's doing. I've spent, I think, the last few months sort of using a little bit some of these chat bots, and they're good. And they're actually going to be a significant increase in the value of search engines. They go well beyond that, but they're still working with a finite amount of stuff. They don't have the kind of discernment that you would expect. And so if you get an answer from the Bing AI chatbot, which I think is better than the ChatGPT, you still got to look at the sources, make sure, okay, because it's citing a source. It may be a fake source that somebody set up, right? And so it's never going to substitute for basic discernment. And especially if it's drawing on something like Wikipedia, which is itself biased by the Wikipedia editors. And so you're not going to get away from the good and the bad of human beings are behind these systems. Now, a really good chat AI is going to be one that overcomes this, right? That where you could be fairly confident, okay, it's not going to give me kind of politically biased angle on this stuff. It's going to do its best to look at the amount of data available on the internet. It can't do anything else, but it's going to do it in a fair way. And so I think there's going to be a comparative advantage to the chatbot that actually does that well. But again, no one should imagine, I've used about seven of these now, I think. There's no temptation to think I'm dealing with an agent. What I'm dealing with is something that was just, it's fancier than the search engine that came before it, but it's not a fundamentally different kind of thing.
The temptation to plagiarize using AI, students, for example, being able to write papers using AI. My son, David, I think he typed into the AI, who is Hank Hanegraaff? And it came up with a, I thought, gosh, that someone in our organization could have written that.
Yeah. Well, and so what it's doing, Hank, is it's probably pulling from other articles and other bios that that are on the internet. And so professors and teachers have to get sophisticated. Now, the good news is that this stuff gets built in. So already in the most up-to-date Microsoft Word, there's, you can go to the spelling and grammar on Microsoft Word and ask it, okay, find, I would say a 2,000-word paper, find if there are other things on the internet like this. And it will give you a percentage, like, okay, if it says 2%, that means there's only 2% of the closest thing that they can find is only 2% like it. So, and this is valuable to make sure you're not plagiarizing yourself. But, you know, we at Catholic University, we had the same sort of kind of filters in which you filter these things. The problem is they're not going to be able to search for the text once it gets sort of uniquely constructed in these chat bots. And my prediction is that to really test the competency of students, we're going to probably have to move more and more to oral examinations. In fact, back to the kind of gold standard of seminar liberal arts education, in which the kind of synthesis of ideas extemporaneously on the fly, in which you're speaking them, ends up being the kind of best way to test people, because that can't be replicated. I mean, to cheat on that, the student would have to memorize a heck of a lot of stuff. And then any student that went to that trouble would have been fine taking a test.
Yeah. You know, Jay, I love talking to you. I mean, you're a wealth of information on so many different subjects. Sort of a summary statement for this podcast from your book, page 208. Once we have recovered our grasp of who we are, then we will see why we should neither worship our technological future nor dread our technological future. It may distract us. It may ease our burdens. But it need not and it cannot replace us. I think that's a great summary statement for the book. I tell you, this book, honestly, there was a lot of hysteria around AI, and I didn't know how to think about it, all aspects of it. So I thought, I got to go back and reread this book. And like I said, it was the balm of Gilead at that point for me, eased my concern about some of the hysteria. But it's just such a wealth of information, and it's all posited through a Christian worldview, through a Christian lens. Like you say, if you talk about transhumanism or transgenderism with a proper anthropology, everything falls into a proper position.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is one way that you can do apologetics as a Christian, is just to show the explanatory fruitfulness and power of the Christian view of the world. It's not a deductive proof, but say, okay, look, you're thinking of this as a materialist, and look, this is where it's leading you. Try thinking of it as a Christian and see where that leads you.
Jay, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I mean, you're making such an incredible contribution in so many different ways. We're all indebted to you.
Thanks so much, Hank. So good to be with you.
Thank you. And again, the book, The Human Advantage, it is a must. It is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. You can write me at P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Also, if you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe, rate, review, helps a lot. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time with more.